friendship, and here's what they had to say. We're calling everyone to ride along to another shore. We can laugh our lives away and be free once more. But no one heard them calling. No one came at all. 'Cause they were too busy watching.
General solubility rules for common salts and bases. 1.
All Lose image.
Are
ride,
soluble.
Captain, ride.
2.
All Caravels. Acetates
are
you
soluble.
Don't have to be a baby to cry.
Silver acetate, AgC2H3O2.
From
only
a split
moderate.
With the Cowsills.
3.
Matching
all
moral.
Are soluble.
O Caroline.
Silver chloride, AgCl.
Mercury Tim Bush song.
Chloride.
Taking a chance.
And lead chloride,
big country. In a big country.
Is slightly soluble in cold water,
soup activists. Chateau
water.
Girls.
4.
Bob Dylan.
Are soluble,
just like Tom Thumb's blues.
BASO4,
Buddy Miles.
BASO4.
Heart's Delight.
Calcium sulfate.
Aldo Nova.
BASO4.
Fantasy. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Mark Hurst's Tectonic coming right your way. I'll see you next week, friends. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for joining me. I want to just jump right into the intro. We're going to be talking about the war in Ukraine this evening. And I just want to say a few words. I'm gonna play the interview. I'll tell you who's the guest in a moment, but I want to give a little intro so you know what this is about, because this is a different kind of show. Usually, I am talking about the predations of big tech on all of us, or the emergence of a new technology in everyday life, or something of that matter. This time I'm going to be talking about the war in Ukraine and the role of digital technology there. So there is a tech angle. It's just coming in a slightly different kind of context. I want to acknowledge there are multiple major active conflicts in the world right now. There are three really big ones. There's the war in Ukraine. There's the war in the Middle East. And there is just a horrific situation in Sudan right now. And of the three, the conflict that has gotten probably the least publicity is probably Sudan. And that's just not my focus for this evening. But it's worth acknowledging that there are other crises and tragedies unfolding in the world. But this episode of Tectonic is going to focus on the war in Ukraine for a number of reasons. First of all, there is a new book out that I really appreciated. It's called Our Enemies Will Vanish, and it's written by our guest this evening, Yaroslav Trofimov. And it tells the history of the first year of the war in Ukraine, that is the Russian invasion in 2022. I know the war really it started years before, but if we're talking about the current phase of the war, started with Russia's invasion in February 2022, and the book covers that entire year and a little bit of 2023. I was really happy to speak with Yaroslav Trofimov about the book and his experiences writing the book, and we're going to hear from him in a few minutes. Beyond that, the war in Ukraine and what's at stake there have special resonance for me personally. If you listened to last week's show, I spoke with Silke Carlo, the director of Big Brother Watch, which is an organization in London that is fighting against the emergence of the kind of intrusive Soviet-style surveillance state that George Orwell warned against in his novel 1984, hence the name of the organization, Big Brother Watch. I am totally opposed to the surveillance state that both the UK and the US are building, among other countries, because I'm passionate about freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, and the freedom to disagree publicly with very powerful people, which is something that I do all the time on this radio show. And all of those freedoms are under threat in Ukraine right now as Vladimir Putin's army bears down on the citizens there. Now, Ukraine is a country led by democratically elected leaders, and so this war represents a threat to all Ukrainians' freedom, and they're fighting for their lives. Ukrainians well know what happens to cities that are taken over by the Russians. Just the unspeakable violence, war crimes. So the outcome of this war in Ukraine is going to determine the fate of that country, and it will set a precedent beyond those borders, determining, for example, whether Russia and perhaps China will decide to invade other free countries, whether those countries are in Europe or perhaps
It's Taiwan, or it could be somewhere else. And so the way I see it, one way to fight the authoritarians and their surveillance state and their lockdown of freedom is to support Ukraine. And I do. And one final reason for this interview, topical to this show, is that what's happening in Ukraine is showing how digital technology is changing the nature of war. And I don't bring this up, and I'm not covering this on this show in order to glorify war. Not at all. Instead, I think, unfortunately, that it's important for all of us to gain some fluency around the kinds of technology that's being deployed on the battlefield, because while these technologies are new today, they're going to start showing up in future wars. And those wars could be anywhere. So those technologies are going to, again, unfortunately, I believe they're going to become familiar sites in battle zones across the globe. So you'll hear in our interview that Yaroslav and I do talk about the roles of technology, the role of technologies like drones and Starlink, and we touch briefly on the role of one individual who keeps popping up on this show, who is intimately involved in Starlink, and of course, that's the CEO, Elon Musk. So those are the reasons why I have chosen to focus this episode of Tectonic on the war in Ukraine. I hope you find it enlightening, and I hope you now understand a little better why I feel it's so important that we become acquainted with what has happened in Ukraine, what is happening today, and what is at stake in Ukraine that will affect all Ukrainians and everyone else who lives currently in a free country. With that in mind, let's go ahead and listen now to my interview with Yaroslav Trofimov, author of Our Enemies Will Vanish, here on Tectonic. Yaroslav Trofimov, welcome to Tectonic.
Great to be on the show.
Great to have you. You are the chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and you've written an important new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, covering the first year of Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. One thing I appreciated about the book is the firsthand account it gives of the war, because you were there. In fact, you were in Kyiv the day before Russia invaded. You described this in the opening of the book. What was it like in Kyiv as the war started?
Well, you know, it was a really weird sensation because I was giving a tip-off by a former president of Ukraine the afternoon of the day before the war began. So I had this knowledge, which I shared with my colleagues and told people I knew that, you know, go somewhere safe. But the city was still living a normal life, you know, people going out in bars, there was traffic in the streets, shops were open, there was no sign of panic. And then suddenly, as darkness fell on Kyiv, there was this sense of something imminent. President Zelensky went on TV in his last pre-war speech, you know, telling the Russians that if you invade, you'll be facing our faces, not our backs. And that we will fight back. And then as we went to bed, I left my windows open because I wanted to hear when it starts. And in fact, you know, shortly after 4 a.m., there was thuds and then more thuds. And the massive Russian missile and rocket attack on Ukraine began. And within the full-fledged war, as tens of thousands of Russian troops and tanks poured across the border in several directions. And by next morning, there was panic to an extent, because lots of people were taking out their families, their children, to safer places in Western Ukraine. Russian forces had landed in an airfield just outside Kyiv with helicopters and were trying to take over that airfield and use it to bring many more troops and equipment with planes, with fixed-wing aircraft. And the first coalescing popular resistance was just beginning as people picking up guns and going to the front lines to try to stop this Russian onslaught.
And despite Putin's expectation of a quick victory, Ukraine was able to survive the onslaught from the much larger Russian force. As for why that happened, you write in the book quite a bit about the funding and equipment from U.S. and European allies, but that all came later. It seems like early on, one of the key decisions was President Zelensky's insistence that he was not leaving the country, even against the advice of some of his allies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you have to remember that back then, everyone in power in Moscow, but also in Washington and in London and in other capitals, was expecting Ukraine to collapse in a matter of days. I mean, the idea that Ukraine, this, you know, relatively small country, poor country, with a small military, would be able to resist on its own against Russia, you know, this nuclear superpower, you know, with one of the biggest militaries, most sophisticated militaries in the world, was laughable. And in fact, Ukraine was denied heavy weapons by its partners in the West before the invasion for this precise reason, because people thought that, you know, why would we give the Ukrainians tanks and artillery if the Russians would roll over in any case? And so President Zelensky was offered by Western leaders, and the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson told me, he had called him and told him, why don't you come to London and set up a government in exile, the way the Polish leaders did in 1939 when the Nazis and the Soviets invaded Poland. He refused. And to me, the pivotal moment of this war was exactly that. Remember, it was on day three of the war. Zelensky came out of his office at the presidential palace in Bankova in Kiev with his key advisors. He held up a phone and recorded this very short selfie video in which he said the key words: we are here. We are all here. We're not going anywhere. We're going to fight, and so should you. And I think this really inspired the rest of Ukrainians to fight, because, you know, without a central government, without a president sticking around, it was a touch-and-go situation. And, you know, I was in Afghanistan just several months earlier, in August 2021, when the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, who had promised to fight the Taliban as they approached the capital, Kabul, all of a sudden got on a helicopter and flew off to Abu Dhabi. And within hours, the Taliban were in my hotel and the Afghan state had collapsed. So Zelensky did not do that. And by the morning of the next day, as I was driving through Kiev, I suddenly saw thousands and thousands of people coming out of the high rises, coming out of the buildings to join the military, to go to the front lines and to repel the Russians.
There's this sense throughout your description of these early months of the incredible spirit of the Ukrainian people banding together to defend their homeland. You quote one Ukrainian saying, "We are on our own land and we have nowhere to retreat. We must fight and we must win." This is an existential crisis for the Ukrainian people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there is a historical memory that drives all that, because people know what happened to Ukraine during a rule from Moscow, you know, the artificial famine in the 1930s, cannibalism, you know, millions of people died in Ukraine at the time. They were starved deliberately by the Stalin regime. Then the bloodshed of the war, the Holocaust, and then after that, an insurgency in many parts of the country that it was brutally put down by the Soviets, the annihilation of the Ukrainian intelligentsia. And the Russian plans for Ukraine are the plans that call for return to this past. You know, one of the first things that the Russians do when they seize the Ukrainian town and village is to destroy a monument to the victims of the famine of the 1930s, which they claim never existed. They burn books by Ukrainian authors. They, you know, the Russian narrative now, if you listen to President Putin, is that the Ukrainian language was invented by the Austro-Hungarian general staff and Ukrainians don't really exist. So they are dealing with the genocidal intent by the Russian government of the day. And of course, they view this conflict as existential, which explains why Ukrainians of all kinds, you know, of all religions, you know, Russian-speaking Ukrainians, Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians, you know, Christians, Muslims, Jews, all came together in this resistance. You know, now Ukraine is a country that has a Jewish prime minister and the Muslim minister of defense, for example.
You also write about how early on, there were some promises from Russia that if you allow us to take over your cities, we're going to bring more economic development. We're going to bring you into the fold of Russia. But as the invasion unfolded, a lot of the cities, especially in the east, could see the results of the Russian takeover. The economy was in a shambles. The infrastructure was totally destroyed. And there are all sorts of war crimes being committed against the residents of those towns. Mm-hmm. And so you write about how some of the population in the East that might have been more aligned with Russia initially said, no way, we're sticking with Ukraine.
Exactly. Well, you know, the war didn't really start in 2022. The war began in 2014 with the Russian annexation of Crimea and the invasion of Donbass in eastern Ukraine, the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. And at the time, you know, Russia was not unpopular in eastern Ukraine. And there was, as you rightly say, this promise that, you know, Russia would bring jobs and prosperity and higher salaries. And a lot of people, especially in the older generation, bought into this promise. And there was a degree of genuine support for Russia in many cities in the east and the south of Ukraine. But then we had this sort of almost lab experiment. The areas that remained under Russian rule in Donetsk and Luhansk after 2014 became impoverished, depopulated. Most of the people who used to live there, everybody who could really, escaped either to Ukraine or to Europe or to Russia proper because there were no jobs. The place was run by essentially criminal gangs. And no one really wanted to live like that. I remember going around Ukraine before the full-scale invasion in Kharkiv and Odessa in the south. And everybody knew people who had escaped from the Russian-ruled areas. And this really explains why the resistance was so universal once the Russians actually came in full force in 2022 and why it remains so today. And we are seeing now the results of it, you know, where the Russians have managed to arrive. The cities that they have taken in the last 2.5 years or four, they've razed to the ground. Nobody lives there. You know, they lost tens of thousands of lives of their own soldiers to capture the city of Bakhmut, population 70,000 before the war. And now its population is literally zero because it's just uninhabited ruins.
One of the things I really appreciated about this book was you were, in many cases, sharing your own experiences being near or at the front lines, talking to soldiers, talking to medics, nurses, and of course the citizens of these areas. And I was wondering how you felt being in harm's way yourself. And I want to bring up a quote that I came across in the book. You write that, quote, lack of imagination or outright self-delusion stems from an inclination to minimize danger and to believe oneself to be somehow protected. And I wondered if you were writing that about yourself. Do you feel like you harbored that self-delusion that you would somehow be protected as you're in these very dangerous areas, or was it scary?
Well, it was also about myself. I will not lie. You know, I spent much of my career covering wars and mayhem in all sorts of places. You know, I used to live in Baghdad. I used to live in Kabul in Afghanistan for 5 years before going back there again in 2021. And I took risks to cover all these conflicts. But I think I took much bigger risks in covering the war in Ukraine, in part because I felt a higher sense of duty, because I am originally from Ukraine. I was born in Kyiv. And it's my city where I grew up, where every little piece of geography carries emotional memories of my childhood that I was being bombed by the Russians. It's my country that was being destroyed. You know, it's people I grew up with, they're being killed. And I think the ability to understand what's going on in the society, the every little nuance of the language, the lay of the land, was in a way unique. And I felt that, you know, I just had to use that ability to relay these stories, to push, to go to the front lines, and to tell what's actually going on there in this sometimes very dangerous situations, because I think also the dangers of this war are higher for journalists than there are many other places, especially in Afghanistan or Iraq, where, you know, we had to deal with, you know, threats by insurgents. We didn't have planes or artillery or long-range missiles to hit us.
You mentioned the three AP journalists who were in Mariupol during the siege. And I also watched the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol, which was quite good.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in your book that there was an additional journalist who stayed after the AP journalists were able to escape. And the journalist who stayed was eventually
caught by the Russians and shot.
Right, yeah, there was a Lithuanian filmmaker who remained in Mariupol when my colleagues from the Associated Press left. And he was stopped at the Russian military checkpoint, taken out of his car. And then his bullet-riddled body was found in a trash heap weeks later by his widow. Not the only journalist who was killed by the Russians in Ukraine, obviously. And I think what was really unsettling in this conflict is that the Russians deliberately target hotels where journalists stay. You know, they fire ballistic missiles at hotels that are only used by civilians, mostly journalists and aid workers, in an attempt to make it impossible for us to work. And they've done it many, many times. I think probably a dozen of the hotels where I stayed in Kharkiv, in Zaporizhia, in other major cities, quite far away from the front lines, have been destroyed in the strikes.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're about halfway through my interview with Yaroslav Trofimov, author of the important new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. We are going to get to the use of digital technology next in the remainder of the interview. If you are interested to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments, and you can also read the comments that have been left there by listeners like you. Let's go ahead and now listen to the second half of my interview with Yaroslav Trofimov here on Tectonic. I wanted to shift topics, Yaroslav, because for this show, I'm interested, of course, in the use of technology. And in this war, one of the types of tech that comes up repeatedly in your book is drones. When the war started, the Ukrainian army was using Turkish-made Bayraktar drones. What was their job initially?
Well, the Bayraktars are one of those platforms that are really kind of part of that legacy of past wars that the U.S. had fought. They are big, they're expensive, they fire missiles. They are great against insurgents who have nothing against, aircraft. Just like the Predator drones and other drones that the U.S. had used in Afghanistan, Iraq. But against the Russian military, they were only useful for the first couple of days. And then most of them were shot down. And in fact, Ukraine had to develop an entire new drone capability that is made for modern war, war against their peer or near peer enemy that has an air force, that has air defenses, and where the drones have to be cheap, very cheap, and very, very numerous to get through all these obstacles. And in fact, what we are seeing in Ukraine is a drone revolution. And right now, after 2.5 years of war, Russia and Ukraine are the two countries in the world that are really experienced in modern drone warfare, where things change every few weeks. And the U.S. has a lot of lessons to learn.
Yeah, I noted in the book every time drones came up, and they came up a lot after the Bayraktar drones, then you're mentioning Ukrainian-made drones. There are drones that Moscow is using. You mentioned that Moscow unleashed a swarm of Iranian-made Shahed suicide drones on Kyiv. Is Russia sourcing their drones from Iran, or do they have their own drone industry as well?
Well, let's talk about Russia first. Yeah, so, I mean, Russia had its own drones before this. They had mostly reconnaissance drones, the Orlans. They have this called Landsat drones, which are strike drones that are quite small and are used against equipment. So, you know, you kill a tank with a Landsat. What they got from Iran were these long-range very big winged Shahed drones that can fly hundreds of miles, that can reach any corner of Ukraine. And they carry a pretty large warhead, so they can destroy a building. And Russia is still unleashing them pretty much every night on Ukrainian cities. And, you know, they're big enough to damage a power station, certainly big enough to, to destroy equipment. And Ukraine has gotten much, much better in defeating them. They're deploying these mobile teams with late 19th century machine guns coupled with modern night vision devices that actually are quite effective. But when you talk about drones in general, I think everything's a drone now. I mean, it's sort of every way this war is fought involves drones. So you have the whole gamut. So, for example, I think the biggest revolution we see now in the past year and a half is the FPV drones, which are really cheap devices. I think it costs maybe $300 to make it. You attach to them an anti-tank bomb from the 1930s or 1940s. It can fly 10 miles, maybe 20 miles, and it can destroy a tank that costs millions of dollars. Both sides use it. And it's very efficient against Russian T-80 and T-72s, but it's also very efficient against American-made Abrams tanks. And that's a revolution. You have naval drones. You know, Ukraine has developed, and it doesn't have a navy, really, but it has developed a naval drone industry in which its naval drones can hit ports in Crimea in Russia and have really crippled the much more expensive Russian navy in the Black Sea. You have the reconnaissance drones that both sides are using to great effect that are flying over enemy territory and are guiding missile strikes, dozens, sometimes more than 100 miles away. And then what Ukraine has really developed in the past year and a half is this long-range drones that can go more than 1,000 miles, including the new ones that are reactive drones. So they have propulsion engines that kind of blur the line between a drone and a missile, really. What is a drone and what's a cruise missile?
Right.
How do you find the boundary? And these have been used to strike military targets like ammunition depots, airfields, far, far away in Russia. So it's a critical element of Ukraine's way of waging the war, but also Russia's.
Yeah. Just to give listeners a sense of the scale of these drone operations, you write that, quote, all over the Ukrainian front lines, hundreds, if not thousands, of these commercial drones were in the air at any given time during daylight hours, augmented by fleets of more sophisticated DJI commercial quadcopters and winged drones manufactured specifically for the military.
And that was early in the war. That was in the very early days when the Ukrainians and the Russians relied mostly on, as you say, Chinese-made DJI drones that were souped up and used for reconnaissance. That was before the FPV revolution. FPV is the first-person view drones. And now there are thousands of them being flown at all times. They're so cheap that... just imagine the calculation. You know, one single artillery shell, a 155 millimeter, costs about, let's say, $3,000 to $5,000. And then these are not precision weapons. You need to fire several of them, maybe a dozen, to hit a target. One FPV drone at $300 can do that. You know, there are roads that are now basically impassable and within 20 miles of the front line on both sides because any moving vehicle just gets hit by those FPV drones.
Now, in addition to drones, there's another technology that comes up in the book, which is Starlink. And I think this may even relate to how the drones are used or even guided. But let's talk briefly about Starlink. Starlink, of course, is the space-borne network of satellites that deliver internet access down to the ground. It's owned by Elon Musk, and it comes up a number of times in the book. For example, you write about the siege in Mariupol of the Azovstal steelworks, in which Ukrainian holdouts in the siege were supplied by helicopters that brought essentials like medication and ammunition. But you write that, quote, the most important cargo that these choppers unloaded were boxes containing Starlink satellite terminals. Talk to me about the importance of Starlink in this conflict.
Yeah, Starlink was really critical for Ukrainian forces, especially in the first year of the war, because given the asymmetry of power with Russia, Starlink was one of the equalizers. Starlink terminals were distributed all the way down to platoons, And they allowed all these Ukrainian units in areas where there was no mobile phone signal because of jamming, all the traditional communications were intercepted by the Russians, to establish stable, secure communications and to start sharing, images, video feeds. So you would have things like, suddenly battlefield management was on a much more sophisticated level than what the Russians had. So all of a sudden you had units with tablets on which they could see feeds from drones all over the area. You had some kind of Uber for artillery, because you would have drone feeds and the artillery units could say, hey, can I hide, I have guns within the vicinity of this target, can I do it? And, yes, and there's the coordinates. This advantage in communications really allowed the Ukrainians to hold the ground. A commander in Bakhmut explained to me like this: when I, a company commander or a battalion commander, am directing fire and directing the operation, I can sit in safety 20 miles from the front line and see on my screen what's going on. When my Russian counterpart is doing it, he doesn't have Starlink. So he has to sit in the trench next to the drone operator and watch this drone screen, because they don't have a way of relaying this information. What happens is then is that, first of all, the Russians also started getting Starlink. Starlink doesn't work on Russian sovereign territory, but it does work in occupied parts of Ukraine. And through black market dealers, other intermediaries, more and more Russian units starting obtaining Starlink terminals. And they're also using in the same way as the Ukrainians are. And what we're also seeing now with Ukrainian forces operating inside Russia for the last 2 months in the Kursk region, they're having this great impediment of not being able to use Starlink anymore because it doesn't work in Russia.
Wasn't there a moment during the first year or so of the war when Ukrainian units wanted to push forward and Elon Musk personally made the decision to shut down their Starlink access in order, he said, to keep the conflict from going nuclear?
Yeah, so there was a moment when the Ukrainians had a fleet of naval drones with Starlink heading towards the base of the Russian Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol in occupied Crimea. And it's a part of Ukraine that was occupied since 2014. So Starlink didn't work there. And they requested Elon Musk to enable Starlink for their drones, the naval drones, that was relayed through the U.S. government. And he refused because, as he later said, he thought it would lead to nuclear war. Obviously, the Ukrainians later, in other ways, attacked Sevastopol many, many times, basically destroyed a large part of the Black Sea Fleet, hit it with missiles provided by the U.S. later on. And there was no nuclear war. What happened as a result of that is that the Russian blockade of the main Ukrainian port, Odessa, ended, and Ukraine was able to resume international trade by pushing the Black Sea Fleet all the way to the eastern seaboard of the Black Sea.
So it turns out Elon Musk's fears were unwarranted in that case. I'm just wondering, is there a positive or negative attitude among Ukrainian forces, Ukrainian people, towards Starlink and Elon Musk, given that he's one individual who has such power to determine the course of the war in some of these moments?
Well, I mean, other than that particular moment, Starlink does work in Ukraine. Starlink is still a critical component of the Ukrainian military communications network. And soldiers are using it, and they're very grateful for that. Now, what Elon Musk may think privately or publicly about Vladimir Putin does not affect the functioning of the communication system.
The way we're talking about drones and Starlink and their interrelationship shows that this conflict is maybe more reliant on decentralized technology than other conflicts that predate it. As you said, there are hundreds or thousands of drones by both sides with great precision. And in fact, the precision of the drones have allowed the Ukrainian army to hold off the Russians. Do you think that continues through this conflict? Or what do you think the future of the use of drones and Starlink and some of these other high-tech armaments are?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a very rapid evolution. You have this cat and mouse game. Because for every measure, there is a countermeasure. And so for every innovation, there is a way to diffuse it. So the more sophisticated are the drones, the more sophisticated is the jamming. And so now what we're seeing, for example, recently in Kursk on the Russian side, the Russians started equipping the drones with wire, optical wire. So all of a sudden, they're completely impervious to jamming because they have several miles of wire by which they can be guided. So, and you have this innovation happening there. Unfortunately, what we're also seeing is that many of the Western weapons manufacturers are not paying attention to this, because many of the Western weapon systems, American weapon systems, you know, get supplied to Ukraine. The Russians find a way to counteract them, but then there is no fix. You know, I mean, the famous one, the famous case that I wrote about was the Excalibur rounds, these precision guided artillery rounds that worked as a miracle, you know, for the first few months. And then the Russians found a way to jam them so they wouldn't explode, it would go off target. The same happened with the HIMARS, some types of HIMARS and GMLRS ammunition. And so I think the key thing to keep in mind is that this war is really a lab of technological innovation in which things change very, very rapidly. And the complacency that we are seeing in the West about that could be dangerous.
What do you think the U.S. could do to assist in the continued development, that lab of technological innovation? Is it acting on the feedback about how the American equipment is being jammed, or is it investing in more drones or buying more drones from Ukrainian factories, or what?
Well, I mean, we're seeing that already. So we are now seeing Western companies coming to Ukraine, to Ukrainian drone manufacturers, and there's lots of them in Ukraine. And Ukraine does have a significant military industry. You know, it used to make aircraft before the war, you know, Antonov, for example. And so it is now able to produce enough drones so when they have a long-range attack on Russia every few days, it's hundreds of drones flying, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles. But, you know, there are limitations. U.S. military personnel is not in Ukraine. You know, U.S. defense contractors are very often not allowed to visit Ukraine because of security restrictions by the U.S. government or by the companies themselves. And so this learning process is slow and, you know, very often insufficient.
The title of your book is Our Enemies Will Vanish. And we learn near the end of the book, if we didn't know it already, that that phrase, Our Enemies Will Vanish, comes from the Ukrainian national anthem. And unfortunately, the title has not come true yet. Russia is still inside Ukraine's borders. On the other hand, Ukraine has crossed its eastern border to invade parts of Russia, as you brought up before, into Kursk. Yet Russia, at the moment, maintains control over large parts of the Ukrainian east and south. What do you think is the future of this conflict?
Well, you know, I think what has become evident now is that the war in Ukraine cannot be won in Ukraine. You know, as long as Russia is largely immune from attacks, as long as the life of Russian citizens is not disturbed by the war, as long as the Russian oil exports are not suffering, it's going to be very hard for Ukraine to really keep going, basically with its hands tied behind its back, because it's very asymmetrical in Russia's favor. And that's why Ukraine is investing so much in its drone technology and its ability to strike deep inside Russia. Because I think there's an understanding that only by bringing the Russian economy to its knees and by destroying its military industries, by, you know, striking at its weapons manufacturing facilities, its missile facilities, can Ukraine really force Putin to negotiate an acceptable end to this war?
Do you have a sense of what an acceptable end would look like?
Well, I mean, it would certainly imply a Russian withdrawal from a significant part of Ukrainian territory and a recognition of Ukraine's right to remain an independent nation that will choose its own fate.
I wanted to make sure I asked about your own work, Yaroslav. How can people keep up with what you're reporting, and what sort of stories can we expect from you in the coming months?
Well, you know, you can obviously read my stories in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm writing not just about Ukraine, I'm writing about, you know, many security issues facing the world. I just had an article about the Israeli successes in dismantling Hezbollah and the future of Lebanon and the greater Middle East. And I also have another book coming out in the U.S. in February next year, a novel called No Country for Love, which is kind of a prequel to this one. It's It's based on my family history. It's a story of my grandmother's survival. So probably the darkest period in the history of Ukraine, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, the time of the famine, the Holocaust, the war, the insurgency, and in a time that Ukrainians call the meat grinder of history. And it examines the moral compromises people had to make at the time to survive and to make sure their loved ones survive. It's a story shared by so many in Ukraine, and it really explains the resilience of Ukrainians today, because the spirit of never again really animates so many people fighting now, because they know that the alternative to dark and painful bloodshed that is occurring now is something even worse, a return to the horrors of this past.
That's right. This book is a story of resilience, among other things. And I learned a ton by reading it. I admire the work and the courage that you put into doing the reporting. The book is called Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence, by my guest, Yaroslav Trofimov. Yaroslav, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the last little bit of the show. Thanks for being with me. We just heard my interview with Yaroslav Trofimov, author of the new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. As I think you could tell, I like the book a lot. I learned a lot, and I think it's important for all of us to understand, as I said in my intro, both what has happened and what's happening, but also what's at stake in this conflict. And beyond that, I find it interesting and a little bit, frankly, worrying to see how technology is being deployed, because it sets a precedent, as I said earlier, for future conflicts. If you are interested in the links to various resources, a link to the book, a link to Yaroslav's own website, to relevant news stories, go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and just click on the playlist link next to this episode, the interview with Yaroslav Trofimov. I also want to say, before I go to my concluding comments, I want to say a brief mention. I want to give a brief mention to the October fundraiser that WFMU is in the midst of right now. This is something that the station does every year in October to help pay the bills for the balance of the year. We have a giant fundraiser called the Marathon in the spring, and that funds us quite a bit, but we need a little top off by the end of the year, and so that's what we're doing in October. And so this is just a reminder. I'm not going to say very much, just a minute or two, but if you haven't given, please go to wfmu.org, and there's a giant pledge widget on the homepage, or if you're on the Tectonic playlist, you can find it at the top of the page. I'm looking at my own little pledge widget right now, and it's saying that I'm at 12% raised, 12% of my goal, which frankly is a little bit on the low side for how I'm usually doing in October, given that we're at the halfway point through the month. So if you haven't chipped in already, please go to wfmu.org, chip in $10, $20, you know, whatever you can spare just to keep this radio station going. It's I find this, as I was telling a friend here at the station before the show, this station is one of the only real sources of sanity in a media environment that is just full of motivations and influences and money from larger forces that I want to have no part in. You can go back and listen to my interview a couple weeks ago with Tim Schwab, talking about how the Bill Gates Foundation is funding a lot of things very quietly. That's not what happens here. We're funded by you, the listener, and your donations, 10, 20 bucks at a time, allow me to come on to this show and to spotlight stories that I feel, honestly, I feel are important and I want to tell you the truth about. And so we're able to talk about, you know, drones in the Ukrainian conflict. That's going to be a tough show for you to find on another tech podcast. So please, if you haven't chipped in, please just go to WFMU.org. Just chip in a little bit. Every little bit helps. And frankly, the number of pledges really is a big signal that you are interested in supporting this show and this station. So thanks. And for all of our monthly Swag for Life members, thank you so much for your continued support of the station. I want to say a little bit about what Yaroslav was saying about Starlink. Because this ties into an ongoing thread on this show. So as we heard from Yaroslav, Elon Musk unilaterally decided that Ukraine's naval drones would not be allowed to use his Starlink satellite internet service as Ukrainian forces wanted to in order to attack the Russian fleet, because it would have been using Starlink across Russia's border, across Ukraine's borders into Russia, which Musk did not want to allow. And so what's important here to look at is that this is a decision made by one individual, Elon Musk. And you can, I'll grant, you can debate Musk's decision. Maybe you agree with Musk in this case. Maybe you agree that it was good, better be safe than sorry, have a lot of caution to try to keep this conflict from spiraling out of control, not risk a possible nuclear escalation. Fine. You know, whatever your take is on his decision is one thing, but there's a larger point here, which is that this individual is unelected and unaccountable to any government or military official. And that individual is unilaterally making decisions that can affect the course of the war. And beyond that, where those decisions can affect other conflicts or even other policies that are beyond Ukraine. That is what's concerning to me, is that it's unaccountable power on behalf of this one tech billionaire who's making decisions that can affect a large part of the globe. By the way, did you notice that Yaroslav said that Ukraine's request was for use of Starlink for the naval drones? That request was passed through U.S. government channels along to Elon Musk, who, I will say again, is not, so far anyway, officially part of the U.S. government. So basically, you have the U.S. government waiting to hear Elon Musk's answer on a policy question. And as I often say on this show, we have to look beyond this one moment itself and try to see the precedent, try to see the trajectory we're on. One tech billionaire making decisions on behalf of the entire human race is not any sort of democracy. It's oligarchy. And there is no telling what Musk is going to do next. Well, actually, there is, if I could just digress for a moment and mention that Musk has endorsed Donald Trump for president in the upcoming election. And according to stories in the news this week, he is investing heavily in order to get Trump reelected. And Trump, of course, has stated his interest in winding down the war in Ukraine rather than continuing the support of Ukraine. So this instance of Musk making a policy decision on behalf of the U.S. government is not some isolated, that was kind of weird. No, he is intimately involved in the fabric of power that is going to determine the course of this war and the future of freedom in Ukraine and possibly Europe, Taiwan, and anywhere else these authoritarians want to bring their surveillance state. And just as another data point, this is a story I put on the playlist. You can see it again, find it at tectonic.fm.
This is from today, from the Kyiv Independent, October 14, 2024. The headline is, House Speaker has no, quote, appetite for more U.S. support for Ukraine. And the quote I have here is, U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson said on October 11 that he no longer has, quote, an appetite for further Ukraine funding and hopes that a November electoral victory for Donald Trump will bring a swift end to the war. We have a whole power structure here that wants to stop the funding for Ukraine and allow Russia to do whatever it wants in that country and beyond. And Musk is working very hard in order to get that group of people back in power under the leadership of second-term President Trump. I just find it incredibly dangerous, and I know there are many, many other dangers and warnings and complaints and grim news that I could bring up. But again, this show is not about everything else. It's simply about understanding what's happening in Ukraine and what is at stake for all of us and who are the players who are making various decisions. In one case, totally unelected, unaccountable, unilateral decisions that affect this global conflict. And you have to wonder where this goes next. So keep that in mind next time you drive past a Tesla or walk past a Tesla. One other quick pointer I want to give, and this is on the playlist. You can find it among the links there. There's a documentary called 20 Days in Mariupol. I mentioned it during the interview with Yaroslav. It's a documentary by Mstislav Chernov. It was released about a year ago, November 2023. It is well worth watching. It's streaming on PBS. So if you live in the U.S. and you have a local PBS affiliate, you can probably stream it for free on the PBS website. Again, there's a link on the playlist. I'd recommend it. It's grim and moving, and again, just underlines everything that we have been talking about in terms of the stakes and really the brutality of this conflict. So watch that. Again, it's called 20 Days in Mariupol. The playlist also has links to two other documentaries. One is called Rule of Two Walls, and another is called Intercepted. And those are also from the last year. And so there's a lot going on for you to dive in, watch, read. You can find all these resources on the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And that's about all the time I have for this evening. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, I have a little bit of homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And to go out this evening before Dave Mandel comes on, I have a special outro song. This is the Ukrainian entry to the Eurovision contest back in 2022. It's called Stefania by Kalush Orchestra, and it, in fact, ended up winning the Eurovision contest. Here it is. Have a great week, everybody. Stefania, mamo, mamo, Stefania, розквітає поле, а вона сивіє. Заспівай мені, мамо, колискову, хочу ще почути твоє рідне слово. Вона мене колесала, дала мені ритм, і напевне сило волі не забрати мене, бо дала вона, напевне, знала, може більше і від сола мона. Я завжди до тебе, вона не розбудить, не будить. Мене в сині бурі забере бабулі, відтулі, ніби вони кулі. Дуже добре знала мене, не була обманута, як було дуже втомлена, гойдала мене так.
And good evening, friends. Welcome to another episode of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here presenting this program for you every Monday at 7 p.m. Thanks for joining me. Always a joy and a pleasure to be here spinning records for you. And we're going to... I have a bunch of things from Scandinavia this week, just pure chance. And we're going to start with one of those right now. We're going to start the show with one of those. And we're also going to start the show with a virtually unpronounceable name. This is someone called Alamailman Vasarat. I think that's probably close enough. This is a group based in Helsinki, and we're going to hear something, a recording from 2003, and this is kind of a, I guess, what they generally call people who feel compelled to subcategorize prog rock. This is probably falls in the category of what they call symphonic prog. Very dramatic. It gets very dramatic towards the end, so brace yourself for that. And here we go. We'll be right back.
and music there from the Helsinki-based band known as Alamailman Vasarat. That's the band name, not a human being's name. And we heard a track that will remain unnamed from a 2003 album put out by them. Very cinematic music from Finland, Helsinki. I have an odd short piece that I've been sitting on for a while, and I think it's time to hatch. So I'm going to play a pretty short piece and then right into the next thing, whatever that happens to be. So this is a group called, hard to describe. They're sort of comical. They technically, I would call them sort of a country or bluegrass band, but they're a very, very, very weird country bluegrass band. They are from they're from Finland also, and what they mostly do is goofy cover versions of songs, of popular songs, and they're amazing, amazing musicians. I found out about these. I learned about these guys by seeing them live by chance a year or two ago. And the name is as goofy as their songs, their renditions. The name of the band is Steve and Seagulls, like Steve and Seagulls. Anyway, you get the pun, I think. And the thing about these guys is they're amazing.